Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Donald Gregg, the chairman of the board of the Career Society in New York City, a career CA officer. He served as Vice President George Bush's National Security Advisor and United States Ambassador to South Korea. And in 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name. His latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donald Gregg.
Delighted to be with you. Thank you.
And there are reports now that this secret mission by the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, to North Korea, where he returned with Kenneth Bay and Matthew Miller, who were held captive in North Korea, they returned with him on the plane to their families in the United States, that some of the reasons behind the release, particularly of Matthew Miller, may have been the belief that Matthew Miller was trying to get into the North Korean prison camps to document the brutal conditions. Is there any truth to that? Or do you have any sense of whether that could have been a possible motive?
I think that the entire issue of the gulags and the prison camps is a matter of high sensitivity to the North Koreans. I say that because on the 20th of October, I introduced Ambassador Jang Il-hung of North Korea to the Council on Foreign Relations, where he spoke on the record about human rights in North Korea. He took a lot of flack from human rights activists there because he had been told what to say by Pyongyang, and he could not really answer their questions to their satisfaction. But it was very clear that a matter of great sensitivity to them was the possibility that the UN might take action to try to indict Kim Jong-un for crimes against humanity due to the conditions in the gulags. So I don't know anything about what the young man in North Korea was doing, but if they thought he was going to try and get into a camp, that would be a matter of great sensitivity to them.
And, of course, there was another U.S. prisoner released about three or six months ago. So tell me about, do you have any understanding of how the two countries communicate? Obviously, you've tried to do a lot personally to bridge the gap and to create some kind of back channels. How do they communicate?
Well, it's not very easy. I was at a conference in the UK at the University of UCLAN, which is the University of Upper Lancashire, and there were a lot of people there from the EU, and the EU is an area which has formal diplomatic relations with North Korea. A number of the countries have first-class ambassadors there. For the United States, Sweden handles our interests, and it was very interesting to me that General Clapper's announcement of his trip gave credit to Ambassador Anderson, the Swedish ambassador who covers our interests in Pyongyang. I'm now chairman of the Pacific Century Institute, which is in Chatsworth, California, out near L.A., I've made six trips to North Korea, and in February, four of us, all representing PCI, went to North Korea and heard from them what their economic development plans are, and have heard from them that they needed help in developing these plans, so we've been trying to be helpful on that. And after the meeting on the 20th of October with Ambassador Jang, I took him to dinner and said, "You made it clear that the prisoners have nothing to do with the human rights issue in the North. I was glad to hear that. And I said, this is absolutely the time to release those people. So yesterday, when I heard they had been released, I sent him a note congratulating him, and he responded an hour later, said, thank you very much. We talked about that, and I tried to do what you suggested. So that's the kind of communication we have. It's offline. I have no feedback whatsoever from the Obama administration. I had none from the Bush administration. I've had no feedback from anybody in the White House since I started going to North Korea. But I think it's been worth doing. And PCI now, I think, is a fairly well-trusted entity by them, and I think they talk fairly freely to us.
So, Donald Gregg, I'm sure there are people in our audience who are wondering why a former CIA officer would feel compelled to feel that there's a need to communicate with North Korea and to get beyond the demonization, which seems to be very popular in all political and journalistic circles.
What a wonderful question. I love the fact you asked me that. And the answer is very simple. I'd rather talk to them than fight them. I was involved for 4 years in the war in Vietnam, which we never should have fought. And I've observed, what happens when we do demonize foreign leaders. It costs us. And we certainly have demonized Kim Jong-un, calling him into question from the moment he appeared. The North Koreans think very highly of him. When I last went there in February this year, Vice Foreign Minister of Foreign Affairs said, the sky's the limit under Kim Jong-un. They think very highly of him. And I think this decision to release the prisoners comes directly from Kim Jong-un. I think it's the kind of decision he's going to start making. He's going to be around for a long time. I think we need to help him understand us better, and I think we need to understand them better than we do. For more than a decade, I've called North Korea the longest-running failure in the history of American intelligence, and I feel that that applies to intelligence organizationally, and it also applies to us intellectually.
Well, it would seem to me, just based on what you just said, Donald Gregg, that much of what we do in terms of our foreign policy, whether it's George W. Bush or his successor, Barack Obama, we sort of follow this line, which goes back to George W. Bush's Axis of Evil speech, where if you put Iraq, Iran, and North Korea beyond the pale, then there you don't have recognition, you don't have embassies, you don't have people on the ground. All you have are the overhead national technical means to look at what's going on, which doesn't tell you very much. So I'm always puzzled as to why rhetorically we place people beyond the pale, which completely blinds us to what's really going on.
Well, that's an apt description of the process that takes place, and I've been particularly disappointed that Obama seems to have inherited some of the worst tendencies of the Bush administration in that reason. I hand-carried to the White House in 2002 a written offer from North Korea, from Kim Jong-il, to restart talks. And I was in and out of the White House in 20 minutes, and Condoleezza Rice's deputy said, oh, no, we won't talk to them. That would be rewarding bad behavior. And we have now something called strategic patience, which is essentially the same thing. We're sort of hoping that North Korea will implode, and they're not going to implode. And the longer we don't talk to them, the stronger their nuclear deterrent becomes. The North Koreans have made it very clear to me that they want to talk to us, but that until we sit down and really talk to them without a lot of preconditions, they're going to continue to strengthen their nuclear deterrent. And so I think the longer we wait to talk, the deeper the pit we're into that we'll have to eventually climb out of.
Well, we seem to be very concerned about Iran's possible or potential to build a nuclear weapon, even though they say they're not doing so. And one of the reasons, I think, is because if Iran does get a nuclear weapon, it's likely to invite an Israeli preemptive strike, and it's also likely to stimulate the Saudi Arabians to go nuclear. Doesn't the same apply to the Korean Peninsula? The more that North Korea gets nuclear weapons, the more pressure on the South to get nuclear weapons, and the more pressure on Japan to get nuclear weapons. So there's more at stake than just the actual country we're talking about, North Korea.
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, fortunately, Israel is not involved in this, or the sensitivity would be much higher. And at least in the case of Iran, President Obama continues to write letters to Khamenei. And, he's dumped on for doing that. I'm very glad he does, because I think it's extremely important that we reach an agreement with Iran. I think North Korea is not a nuclear threat to anyone. I think they know that if they used a nuclear weapon, they would be obliterated. But as you say, if they get them, others will be tempted to, and there are right-wingers in South Korea who are already talking about developing nuclear weapons, something that I had a hand in stopping when I was chief of station there in the mid-70s.
So what then is the likelihood of following on from James Clapper's, the opening that clearly, and you suggested came, the decisions came from the North Korean leader to release the American prisoners. What do you think the next step could be or should be?
Well, I wish that it were more of an opening than it seems to be, because the White House has bent over backwards to say that he wasn't there to negotiate anything. I think he's a very intelligent, experienced intelligence officer. I think he picked up a lot of vibes from what he saw there. I think that's all to the best. All I'm in position to do is to suggest that we meet with Ambassador Zhang and discuss the possibility of a Council on Foreign Relations delegation going to North Korea, where we can talk about a whole panoply of issues, including perhaps even human rights. So that's what I'm able to at least talk about from my outside position. What the Obama White House is thinking about, I cannot fathom.
But in terms of North Korea's obvious concerns over the UN report on human rights violations, which as you suggested, the ambassador that you talked to, who recently replied to you saying that he'd taken your advice, their concern that Kim Jong-un could be indicted and you know, to basically, you know, held to he would never be extradited, but he could end up being indicted before the International Court of Justice. So what are the North Koreans going to do in terms of dodging that bullet?
Well, I would think that probably one of the things that went through their mind was, let's release these prisoners and that will take some of the heat off us. And I think that was probably, you know, a valid consideration on their part. But that's not a permanent solution. I think the permanent solution can only come where they recognize that they have a terrible problem in terms of the image that comes from running their gulags, and they've got to take that into account. And when people ask me why I keep fooling around with the North Koreans, I say not only I'd rather talk but fight. I said my experience is that totalitarian regimes, and North Korea is a totalitarian regime, they change only when they see that it is in their interest to change. That happened after Nixon reached out to China, and it also happened after George Herbert Walker Bush and Gorbachev worked together to bring down the Berlin Wall. And changes took place. And I think changes need to start to take place in North Korea, internally generated. And so I think these talks to the North Koreans about their human rights problem are very valuable if it translates into actions which they can take on their own volition within their society to make it less less repressive.
And what are the, I mean, clearly the UN is headed by a South Korean. Is there anything to be, any association to be made there? The South Koreans paradoxically seem quite divided. In many ways, there are constituencies in South Korea that many argue are apologists for the North. But then there are other constituencies in and I believe clearly the new leader who's father was killed by North Korean agents. I think his mother, I can't remember. They attacked the
Her mother was killed,
right? Yeah.
And they tried to kill her father twice.
Right, right. So she's got to be a little leery of them. So is there anything at play there?
Yes, there is. I mean, I think the changes in, or the division in views is somewhat age-based. Older people remember the horrors of the Korean War and are still very much fearful and negative about North Korea. Younger people are more flexible. But the Kim Park Geun-hye, I met her in 2002. She went once to North Korea, and I congratulated her for doing it. And she said to me, I'll never forget it, we must look to the future with hope, not to the past with bitterness. But unfortunately, her Nordpolitik policy really hasn't come to amount to much, but she still has over 2 years left in her presidency, and I hope she will do more. And if she did do more, that would be makes it easier for the United States to rethink its strategic patience policy and start to open up.
And quite often, our analysts tell us that the key to solving the problem between on the Korean Peninsula lies with China. And I can't imagine that China would have any interest in the North collapsing. They wouldn't want the U.S. military back on the Yalu River, would they?
Absolutely right. I mean, the Chinese are much more concerned about political implosion or explosion, either one of which would trigger a mass exodus of North Koreans into China. So they are much less worried about a small nuclear capability, which they know the North Koreans will not use. I think China has played a useful role in putting a certain amount of pressure on North Korea, but we cannot expect China to do our work for us. The Chinese and the North Koreans have 1,000 years of hostility between them, and they don't like each other. And so at some point, the key to stability in that whole region is the reestablishment of a solid relationship between the United States and both halves of the Korean Peninsula.
Well, just in closing, Donald Gregg, the Berlin Wall, of course, came down 25 years ago, and there is an article in Sunday's New York Times suggesting that China and Putin are getting closer together. And you mentioned Nixon's opening to China, which effectively put the U.S. in the catbird seat, being able to play China off against Russia. Have the Chinese reversed that, and now is President Xi in the catbird seat, being able to play Putin off against Obama?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell that, but I think it's very interesting that President Obama, who I think is a very astute judge of people, he's going to be seeing both of them up close and personal on this trip that he's just started in Asia. At the conference that I attended in the UK a couple of weeks ago, there were some very intelligent senior Russians with whom I talked, and I said, look, I fought you guys in CIA all through the Cold War, but I have huge amount of respect for Russia, and if this century is going to be any better than our last, we have to find ways to work together on certain issues. And they said, well, we would agree with that, but you've got a very difficult situation with Putin, who is totally in control and has reawakened in the minds of the Russians and the hearts their hope of sort of international clout and grandeur. And so we have a real problem coming there. And what role Xi is going to play will become clearer to us all, I think, after Obama sees him on this trip to Asia.
Well, Donald Gregg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for your good questions.
Again, I've been speaking with Donald Gregg, who is the chairman of the board of the Korea Society in New York City, a career CIA officer. He served as Vice President George Bush's National Security Advisor and the United States Ambassador to South Korea. In 2007, the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies established a foreign policy fellowship in the ambassador's name, and his latest book is Potsherds, Fragments of a Life Lived in CIA, the White House, and the Two Koreas. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the hollowing out of the Democratic Party in Congress from two losses in a row in the midterm elections.